From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The founding father of virtual reality wants you to delete all of your social media accounts, like right now. And today on the program, he'll make the case for why. Jaron Lanier is joining us. He's one of the pioneers of the internet. And he has a book, not a long book, but just 10 arguments for why online platforms are undermining the truth, turning you into an a-hole, and destroying your capacity for empathy. We'll be right back.
KUER is listener-supported public radio. And our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jaron Lanier says that in this experiment that is the internet, we're all lab animals now. Because with our smartphones and laptops, we're being tracked and we're being measured constantly by these big and wealthy companies like Google and Facebook. Lanier has a way with words, and the way he puts it in his latest book is that we're being hypnotized little by little by technicians we can't see for purposes we don't know. And look, Lanier is not by any stretch a Luddite. He is a pioneer of the internet. He pretty much helped create virtual reality. He thinks people should embrace the internet, but he just hates the business model that has emerged in the digital age. He says what's going on is not old school advertising where you had someone make their pitch to sell you something. This, he says, is different. These companies have these algorithms that are constantly monitoring and prodding our behavior. And the result, he says, is unethical. And it's cruel and inhumane. And so in the book, he makes these 10 arguments for why you should delete all of your social media accounts right now. Jaron Lanier is speaking in Park City tomorrow night. So we're taking the opportunity to rebroadcast our conversation with him. We'll give you details about the event as we go along. Lanier is a musician, a scientist, a writer. He joined us from a studio at the University of California Berkeley School of Journalism. And we began our conversation with the perfect metaphor that he's come up with that expresses his hopes for the internet. It's a cat.
Well, anyone online, which means essentially everyone, has noticed that there's a special place for cats, that there are an abundance of cat memes and cat videos and so on. And I was starting to wonder about what it is about cats and the internet. And I think I understand what that's about. And it's that of all of the domesticated animals in our lives, cats are the only ones that aren't really domesticated. You can take a house cat and I don't recommend this, but you can put it out in the wild. And if it's a plausible environment for the cat to survive, and the cat will survive, the cats have not lost their wild nature. They still think for themselves. They're not easily or reliably trainable as compared to other domesticated animals. And the archaeology suggests they kind of ingratiated themselves into our lives rather than we capturing them and domesticating them. And so you have this creature in our lives that is integrated into modernity, is able to live in a modern world, take advantage of it, navigate it, but has not lost itself, has remained independent. And I think that's what we dream can happen for people, but we're not sure that that's where things are going. So I think that's why cats are so popular.
Dogs are another matter. Dogs, so you, cats have somehow, as you say, managed to integrate into this high-tech world, but they haven't given up their agency. Dogs are sort of where we are right now, or at least that's where a lot of us are. And how explain how they're different, a dog.
Yeah,
from a cat.
And I want to be really careful here because I don't have anything against dogs or dog lovers, and I really want to be clear about that.
Yeah,
and I've met the occasional dog that acts like a cat, and the occasional cat that acts like a dog.
Of course.
So it's not, like, let's just be clear. Let's not overgeneralize here. Okay, we're not profiling, but you know what I mean. And
yep.
Dogs do take to training. They do they're willing to put themselves kind of below us in a hierarchy. And cats really aren't. You know, they say dogs have masters and cats have staff. And there's some truth to that, you know.
Yeah.
And so nothing against dogs. Dogs are great. But there is a difference. And I think the question is, are we becoming like dogs?
Yeah.
I mean, there are great things about dogs. I don't want – once again, I'm not besmirching the dog nature of dogs. But I am saying that there's this sense in which we feel like we're losing our own agency. We're becoming subservient. We do what algorithms think we should do more and more, and we get our sense of reality from algorithms, and we're not sure we can trust them, and everything is starting to feel a little unreal. And then if you listen to Silicon Valley, we're all about to lose our jobs to AIs and robots. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's sort of like technology is becoming the master of everything. Technology is becoming God. And that puts us in a subservient position. And I don't think anybody wants to go there. And yeah. I don't think there's any reason anyone should.
Just to make this clear, as you do kind of throughout the book, you are you're an optimist, and you don't think the problem is the internet itself or the smartphone itself. You don't think screens are this existential problem for our species. The problem, and we'll get to this as we go, is the business model that has come from all of this.
Yeah, that's what I think. I mean, to me, the problem is really specific. The problem is that behind the scenes, the only way a few of the big tech giants like Google and Facebook can make any money is if there's some third party you don't know who thinks they can change your behavior through subtly measuring you and then changing the experiences you get online as a behavior modification package in the way you train a horse or a dog. And right now, just to be clear, if you're getting something free online like search or social media, that exists because those third parties are out there who think they can change you. And I just think having this idea of sneaky manipulation being so central to society and so universal is such a ridiculous way to run a culture or a civilization that it's not survivable. And it's that manipulation machine I think we have to shut down.
One of the things that you've talked about is that you had this kind of idealism early on in the digital culture. I mean, you were one of the first, of course. And you've talked about how you and your colleague pioneers had this sense that I think this can go either really good or this can go really bad. And in some ways, it's gone kind of bad. And you've called this the tragedy of your generation. And I'm wondering if this book and the way you've been talking about this lately is kind of a way of, I think you put it this way, unraveling the mistakes that you made and trying to and it seems like you feel responsible in some way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm in an unusual position, close to unique. I can think of hardly anyone else who's continued to be active in the industry while being so critical of it for such a long period. And so I always run through my mind, could I have been critical in a different way that would have gotten through better? Or should I have been tougher? Were there times when I was too nice or too polite? The few other people I can think of who were in the industry and saw the same things I did just left. They just couldn't handle staying in it. Now, I should say things are very different now, and this is one of the reasons why I'm so optimistic. There's a new generation of younger engineers mm-hmm. and entrepreneurs in the tech world who really want to change things. And I don't feel like I have an unusual position anymore. In fact, some people have said, well, you're just saying the same things everyone else is saying. And I'm like, yeah, well, I mean, I've been saying them for a long time. But if the problem is that I'm saying things that you've already heard, that's a great problem to have.
Yeah.
I like that problem.
Yeah.
But I do feel changes in the air. People are really concerned about what we're doing. You've probably heard some of the public regrets and denunciations from some of the top people at Facebook, for instance, and at Google,
yeah.
who have said that they don't know what it's doing to kids. They think they've done something horribly wrong and have damaged society. The head of Twitter said something similar. So there's a widespread realization. And of course, that's different from doing something about it, but we're mm-hmm. definitely in a more hopeful zone than we were even a couple of years ago.
Well, that's one of the things you say in the book is that awareness is crucial. This idea of being aware of all of these things, that's like one of the most critical first steps, I guess.
Yeah, and I would say at this point, there's pretty widespread agreement on the nature of the degradations. It's not universal, but I think there's a pretty widespread agreement that this constant sneaky behavior manipulation is bad for kids, bad for families, bad for relationships, that it makes people sad and paranoid. It makes it too easy for bad actors to get involved in politics and manipulate people. There are all kinds of things about it that I think there's widespread agreement on, even if there's some disagreements about what the right politics should be. Mm. Even people all across the spectrum can see that there's something very wrong with what's going on. There's not as much of a consensus about what to do about it. Yeah. That's where things get tricky. And within the big tech companies, they tend to say, well, let's just do more of what we're doing. So we'll apply AI algorithms to try to enforce morality with people and stop the people who are saying bad things or whatever. And that, I just think that's hopeless. I don't think that makes any sense. And then they're, the Europeans are saying, well, we'll get the government to come in and slam these companies. And, you know, maybe let's see how that turns out. I really think there's an overwhelmingly obvious answer here, which is to change the business model.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I love business. I love capitalism. But there are a lot of different ways to run a business. And if your particular business model is destroying your society, it's not doing anybody any good, obviously. So let's just change the business model. That seems to be the right path to me. I would say I don't have total agreement from everyone else as yet.
Yeah.
But it just seems logical, you know?
Yeah. Well, what do you mean when you say, because it seems just kind of outrageous and for a lot of people it seems impossible when you say delete your social media accounts and delete them right now. I mean, one of the things you say in the book is, look, if we're going to test the potential for trying something else, let's at least try this, and we have to commit to it in order for that to be meaningful. Talk a little bit about that, because it seems like, oh, does he really mean it? That seems crazy.
Yeah. Well, look, I would compare social media to two other problems that society has dealt with effectively in the past, although they have differences. One of them was Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, and the other was the movement to remove cigarettes from the public spaces.
Yeah.
And work. So in both cases, you had a situation of mass addiction where just a lot of people were really hooked on this stuff, and it was hard to imagine anything being different. And in both cases, people nonetheless were able to create a change, and basically just through common sense. They're saying, look, it's just common sense that if you get drunk in a car, you're going to kill somebody sooner or later. So just don't do that. Common sense. Common sense. If you want to smoke in your own house, that's one thing, but don't subject kids to it out in a public place. Common sense. And gradually, after a lot of consternation, society as a whole adjusted to it. And I think almost everybody feels like in both cases it was for the better. And we've seen far fewer cases of cancer as a result of the reduction in cigarette smoking, for instance. So this is a little like that, except there's a couple differences. In the cases of tobacco and alcohol, not as many people are addicted as is the case for social media. The addiction is much more widespread. Mm-hmm. And then there's this other layer, which is a little geeky, which we call network effect. And what that means is if everybody else is on Facebook, it's hard for you to go off it, because then you can't even organize a soccer game for your kids because everybody's on Facebook and you're not. And it's impossible to get everybody to move all at once, so everybody's stuck there. So that's called a network effect. And between addiction and network effect, it's really not easy to imagine everybody getting off the stuff. However, the reason Mothers Against Drunk Drivers and the movement to reduce cigarette smoking worked is that there were at least a few people who weren't addicted, who were outside of the system and could look at it from outside without the veil of addiction, without the hypnosis of addiction. And they could say, this is stupid. You know, there's another way. Yeah. And what I'm hoping to do is at least get enough people to quit so that we can start to have that larger conversation where some people can look at this from the outside and say, wow, once I'm not on this stuff, I can really see how stupid it is. And if it doesn't take a lot of people, maybe 5 or 10% of the people in the conversation, just to get that perspective. And then I think we can start to have a societal change.
Explain how this works. With argument one is that we're losing our free will. And I think to understand all of this, we have to understand some basics. It's what you describe as the algorithmic behavior modification. This is really important for people to understand if they don't already. For those who don't, give us a sense of just how monitored we are and how much constant feedback we're receiving, engineered and tweaked constantly, it seems.
Right. So behaviorism is this branch of science that started quite a long time ago in the 19th century. And what it suggested is that you don't need to think about whispering in an animal's ear or hugging a child or any of that stuff. If you want to change the behavior patterns of an animal or a child, all you need to do is in a very kind of sterile way, watch what that creature does in response to different events, and then change the events accordingly until that creature does what you want it to do. Typically, it's divided into reward and punishment. And in the old classic days, the reward and the punishment might have been, let's say, candy and an electric shock. But then way back at the dawn of this science, Ivan Pavlov showed that it didn't have to be a real reward. He famously showed you could get a dog to salivate just from a bell if it was used to a bell ringing whenever it ate. So you could move to symbolism. And in fact, that's a lot of how modern gambling works. They use symbols in order to addict people to gambling. And so that's why, for instance, you'll see images of things like candy and games like Candy Crush, because they're serving as a symbol stand-in for an addictive element. So getting somebody addicted to something in itself is maybe not the best thing in the world, but it's kind of neither here nor there. All of us are going to be addicted to something or other sometimes. There's no such thing as a person who's totally addiction-free. That's one of the issues with human nature. And, you know, only some sort of super perfect person would be able to claim like perfection. So, but the thing is, you can leverage that, the addiction that you create through behavior modification to also, or that you create this way for behavior modification to change people. And that's when things get dicey. Yeah. If the only purpose of the modification is to get the person addicted to keep on doing whatever it is, that's one thing. But if you're then doing it to change their character, change the way they think about the world, that can be something really pernicious. If it's like having a hypnotist who you've never met, who's actually being paid by some third party for some reason you don't know, and you're trusting that hypnotist. And that's essentially what's going on. So every penny that is made through this, and this is the vast majority of both the revenue and the profit of companies like Google and Facebook, comes from people who think they can change your behavior. And a lot of times it's just the stuff that you would expect, like go get coffee at this place instead of that other place, or get your gas at this station instead of that station or whatever. The problem that comes in is that it can also be used for other purposes. And in particular, there's this weird thing that on social media, you end up using emotions for the rewards and the treats. So you give people a good feeling when they get retweeted or go viral once in a while or something like that. And you give them bad feelings when they're afraid they'll be ridiculed or when they actually are ridiculed or simply ignored or whatever it is. And so you can leverage these things most easily to bring up emotions related to that kind of feedback. And there's this unfortunate thing about human nature, and this is once again slightly geeky, and I apologize for it. The negative emotions like feeling paranoid or angry or scared or whatever, those things rise more quickly in people. They're startle responses, fight or flight. And the positive ones of gaining trust, gaining admiration, and all that sort of stuff, they take longer. And since the algorithms are measuring what you do after you've been stimulated, they pick up on the negative ones. So they tend to reinforce them. So you can use these systems to make people cynical and angry more easily than you can make them trusted and educated or something like that. And so that's why when somebody wants to influence an election, they try to suppress voters more than stimulate voter turnout, because that just works better with this system. The way you're measured is by an increasing number of ways. It used to just be who you knew, but now it's like where you are, mm-hmm. how you're walking, your facial expressions in many cases, your voice tone. It's just like everything possible that can be gleaned from the devices you use. And all of those things are correlated with millions of people who have anything in common with you. And then you're watched after you get a certain stimulus, like a certain post or a certain ad or whatever it is. And then the algorithms determine if you do anything differently than you probably would have based on past patterns. And so that's the system.
So it seems like the big difference is in terms of the business model now is that – so in the past, a product, if you're a company, if – it when it got traction, it was about selling the product. Now the business model is whether a person changes their behavior. That's the product. That's the measure of
exactly.
success.
Yep, that's it. And that's all it is. And I really want to emphasize this is totally different from traditional advertising. Yeah. Traditional advertising was a form of message, but it wasn't individually tuned to each person based on these algorithms. And so you can draw a fine line between advertising and behavior modification. And I find advertising annoying once in a while, but I don't think it's an existential threat to our civilization. Yeah. I don't think it's going to destroy our nation. But this universal behavior modification is a threat that could destroy our nation and our species. It's of a totally different order.
That's Jaron Lanier. His latest book is called 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts. Tomorrow night at 7:30, he's going to be speaking at the Eccles Center in Park City as a guest of the Park City Institute. For tickets and information, just go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have the internet pioneer Jaron Lanier with us, making his 10 arguments for why online platforms are undermining the truth, making you unhappy, and destroying your capacity for empathy. The book is 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts. Explain what a bummer machine is.
I got tired of repeating myself, so I wanted to come up with a little acronym.
Right.
So it stands out for behaviors of users modified and made into an empire for rent. And I just used it as a convenience. Some people don't like it because it sounds a little too schoolyard dirty or something like that. I don't know. I mean, at some point you just have to simplify your language, and that's all it is. So the bummer is just the term for everything I've been talking about
here.
Yeah.
One of the arguments you write about is you kind of get at why it is that people are nasty online. And the chapter headline here is social media is making you into an asshole.
So there's a few different things going on here. As I mentioned, the algorithms that are measuring how you change in response to the changes in your feeds on services like Facebook or YouTube, those algorithms pick up on the faster changes more readily, and the faster changes tend to be the startle responses like anger, fear, and resentment, jealousy. And those things therefore get amplified and amplified. So that's part of the reason why people's character is degraded. Another reason is just that addicts have a certain kind of personality disorder. And it doesn't matter whether somebody is addicted to a drug or gambling or social media or whatever, they tend to get lost in the cycle of getting their fix, and they tend to become very self-obsessed because everything is so tightly wound around that one thing, and they tend to not be as aware of people around them. And they tend to – one of the really strange things about the addict's personality is that the thing they're addicted to isn't the high, but the whole cycle after a while. Because just like Pavlov's dog with the bell, they associate the whole cycle with the high. So the gambler is addicted to the whole process in which they'll usually lose, right?
Yeah.
And the heroin addict is addicted to the whole process in which they're usually in trouble. And the social media addict gets addicted to getting into nits with people and getting getting attacked. And we can see social media addiction in a lot of people. We saw it in Elon Musk when he started suddenly accusing this diver who helped save the Thai boys of being a pedophile out of nowhere. That's just his social media talking, his social media addiction. The president has a severe social media addiction, and it's really degraded his character. And that's a totally separate question from anything about his policies or anything else.
Yeah.
I met him a few times over the decades, and he didn't used to be this way. This is something that's fresh, and it's from his Twitter addiction.
You say early in the experience with social media yourself that it was all pretty basic, but you began to notice that sometimes out of nowhere you would say that you yourself would get into a fight with someone or some group, and you started to wonder what it was that was going on.
There's this other layer, and so even before there was a manipulation machine in place, there was this phenomenon that if people connected online, they tended to get nasty and sort of paranoid and vindictive and strangely confrontative and unable to listen to each other in a way that wasn't characteristic of the same individuals out in the real world. And we've all experienced this online. And so the previous explanations I talked about how the algorithms pick up on the negative emotions and how the behavior of an addict is degraded, those are all in play. But there's also this third thing that amplifies them. And the theory I've come up with, and I'm not really certain this is true. It's just my working theory for the moment. It's the best I've seen, and I haven't seen anything better from anyone else. The theory is that people have an ability to either act as lone wolves or members of a pack.
Right.
If you're a member of a pack, the very most important thing to you is politics. What you care about is the pack people who are competing for your position in the pack, your peers, the people below you. You're worried about the people above you. And most of all, you're all worried about other packs who are your opponents, right? And so you get into this mentality. But if you're a lone wolf, you're not into politics as the primary thing. You have to be a naturalist. What you're worried about is, where's food? Where's shelter? Where's water? Is there a predator coming for me? So you're really paying attention to the world, you know?
Yeah.
So it's politics versus naturalism. And there's this switch inside us that can go either way. And it's a good thing that there is, because both frames of mind have their uses, you know, like you don't want a military unit where everybody's just thinking for themselves. Yeah. That would obviously be a disaster. But on the other hand, there's a lot of cases where we need people to think for themselves or else the whole thing doesn't work. Like, let's say in a marketplace, each customer has to make an honest decision. If everybody's being hypnotized so they buy a product that actually isn't the best product, then the whole purpose of the marketplace fails and the whole thing becomes nonsense. And that happens once in a while. You know, we have market bubbles and crazes and tulip crazes. That's when markets fail. And in politics, too, like if everybody's being hypnotized, they're not necessarily voting for the candidate who's actually in their own interest. And so then politics fails. So what I think is going on is that when you're the way that you become a lone wolf is that there's something out there in the real world that matters to you. And so you have to turn on that part of your brain. Mm. But online, since everything's fake, the only thing left is politics. And then you get into this hyper wolf pack mode where you're attacking people and worried about your place in the hierarchy. And I think that's another reason why people screw up so badly. And there's a lot of evidence for that. I should point out that whenever there's something real at stake, like say LinkedIn is one of the big networks, but there's a lower quotient of people being assholes on it. And the reason why is that people are working on their careers. There's something real at stake. So suddenly people have something to actually pay attention to. They have a real stake instead of nothing but sort of abstract politics.
I loved this part, I have to say, because it seems like what it said to me was that The stakes in LinkedIn, for example, weren't about just seeking attention. They were more practical. So practicality, you know, just looking out for our careers and our families, that could in some way be the thing that unifies us, looking at these more practical things.
Well, reality should be the thing that unifies us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't feel like having a society or having a nation should just be a project in symbolism. It should be about reality. We should be making our lives better. We should be, you know, we should be making the lives of our children better than our own. That's what we're here for.
Yeah. But you're right, when we're in a pack, that people lose sight of reality. And a good illustration of that, you mentioned climate deniers. They kind of fit into this.
Yeah, that's an example that's important to me because let's say if technology was so advanced and we were so secure that in a way nothing mattered anymore, then really politics could be fantasy. It could just be this endless football game, a sort of a sport where different teams competed and who cares because it doesn't matter. We have the basics together and it really doesn't matter what we do. But that's not the world we live in. In reality, we actually do have real threats from the real world. So the climate doesn't care if you're a Republican or Democrat. It doesn't care if you're an American or a Russian or whoever. The climate basically is just going to change. And if it's going to destroy human civilization, it's going to do it. And we are influencing it. And to not be able to rise to the occasion and deal with that is suicidal. Stupid, but it's also a typical problem that comes up if you're insisting on being in a wolf pack when you really need to be a lone wolf and pay attention to reality.
How does it work exactly? We don't have to get into this too much, but how are fake people generated and operated? You mentioned a New York Times piece that explained on Twitter, for example, you could buy fake followers for, I don't know, $250 or something like that for like 25,000 people. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. So this thing about fake people is a really big deal. A lot of the way that you drive addiction on these systems is by giving people the feeling that they have all these followers and that their videos have been viewed a lot of times and all that. But the thing is, these views and these followers and these retweeters and all that are often fake people. And the fake people are I call them like the gut bacteria of the tech companies, in that they're not exactly the same thing as the tech companies, but the tech companies need them. They have a sort of a weird symbiotic relationship, and the fake people come from all kinds of sources. I refer to that New York Times story because I thought it was funny. It's basically like these firms that'll sell celebrities. Like a lot of people who are celebrities kind of bought their following at least initially. So yeah, you can buy a few tens of thousands of fake followers for a couple $100s. And I know people have told me, you should do that. You're out there selling books. Why aren't you doing it?
Yeah.
And I just feel like, because I want like whatever dignity I can find in this life.
Yep.
You know, that's why. But some of them are created by bad actors. I mean, this is part of how the Russians affected our election, as detailed by everybody, including, you know, Republican-led committees in both the House and Senate. Everybody acknowledges that part of what they did was create fake persons online in order to create a sort of a fake society of people with a shared belief in order to bring others into that belief system. And a lot of it was voter suppression, but there are all kinds of things going on there. And So those are two different sources of fake people, and there are other ones as well. A lot of times fake people are created by organized crime to, for instance, create a lot of fake reviews for a fictitious seller on some site so that you'll trust that seller, or to create fake reviews of a fictitious product so you'll trust the product, or in particular to create fake associates of somebody who wants to rip you off, where they'll say, well, I know you might wonder, why are you sending me your gold or your money or your credit card or whatever, but you can talk to all of these other people. Yeah. And of course, you can create fake people very easily online. So yeah, the online is mostly fake people.
One of the things you explore is how media companies, Fox News is one of these examples, they've become more partisan. And one of the reasons, you say, is that this this ability to craft this kind of fake social ambience that makes you think a certain way, and everyone gathers together in the same spots. I mean, but it's fake, this social ambience. It's kind of created.
Well, I think what's going on is that the algorithms have this way of amplifying whatever's the most engaging, and what's the most engaging is typically the most paranoid, xenophobic, irritable, scared, aggressive, just all the negative emotions, the fight or flight, startle responses. And so what happens is that people who are the news as editors or writers in traditional media tend to have pretty bad addictions to social media. And so what happens is that what they get out of the world starts to shift because of that, and it starts to change their worldview. And suddenly it seems normal to promote things that are blatantly false. And this is delicate because I really don't want to be partisan. Like,
no,
from my point of view, the stuff I'm talking about should be equally upsetting whether you consider yourself a liberal or conservative. I think traditionally the idea of being a conservative was not associated with being cranky, paranoid, cruel or any of those. I mean, like it was a different – it was just a different philosophy of what the national defense should be, how the state should relate to family life and how economics works best. I mean, it was a set of philosophies, and there could be legitimate differences of point of view, and there were also points of compromise. But it just happens, and I think this is random. I think this is really could have just as easily happened on the liberal side, and to a degree has, just to a lesser degree. But it just happens that the bummer machine really took off on the conservative side in the U.S. I do think it's kind of random. I really do. But it is true that conservative media has tended to be really driven by social media addiction, so that the sense of what is real and what is decent to say comes out of this sort of echo chamber within the social media world that amplifies the worst in our character. So you do tend to see this. And now that happens on the left too.
Sure.
It really happens. It just hasn't been accelerated as much because the machine's picked up more on the right. I think the left has equal potential to do all that, and this should not be a left-right issue. And in fact, within little bubbles in the left, it gets as bad as anything. It really does.
What do you mean, Jaron, when you make the argument, this is argument 5 in the book, social media makes us meaningless?
What I mean by that is there's no way for anything you say to have meaning out of context.
Yeah.
Okay. And I do my best to speak in a way that is clear, but the truth is, like, if somebody just tuned in 3 seconds ago and they listened to me, there's absolutely no way they can understand what I'm saying as well as somebody who listened from the start.
Right.
And that's true for anybody anywhere. Like, context is everything. Context is meaning. Words by themselves don't mean anything. And so when you say something through social media, you don't know the context in which it will be perceived by somebody else, because it might be sandwiched in between other things that put it in a completely different light, or it might be overlaid by somebody in some way, or it might be cited by somebody in some way that's unfair, out of context, or cynical or something. And so everything you put out there is subject to being set in a different context by the algorithms or by other people you don't know. So everything you say is really not meaning what you think it says. And that's why you have like these crazy things where somebody tweets something and then they get in trouble for it. And they're saying, no, that's not what I meant.
Yeah,
and that happens just all the time.
Yeah.
And the result of that is everybody becoming either super defensive or super over the top to try to avoid being recontextualized by others. Mm-hmm. So they either say something super safe that sounds like everybody else, or they'll say something that's so off the wall and so extreme that it does create its own context. But then that's also not real either. So it's really hard and close to impossible to fully be yourself communicating in an online way where your context is created by other people all the time. There are few exceptions. The exceptions are when there's a small group of people with something in common, like people who have a common problem in life, like a rare illness is one example I use a lot because I think it's a benefit of social media that people with rare illnesses can find each other or things like that. You see a lot of like mothers of young children connecting with each other in a way that I think is really helpful to them. And if there's something where you have people who have a lot in common so that you share context, then social media can work. But the problem is that the vast majority of cases don't fall into that pocket. And instead, they just are in this case where nobody means anything anymore.
It's interesting. You say that if you, one of the sort of media places to find a system that hasn't yet been destroyed by, you know, context and meaning is podcasting. Podcasters right now are real, might be ruined at some point, but not yet, you say.
Yeah. So far, each podcast is gotten in its own name. In other words, like if you put out a podcast and you say, this is my daily brain fart, whatever your podcast, somebody gets it. They know it's from you. They know who you are. They can find a continuity with your previous podcasts. There isn't some service where an algorithm is automatically picking out the best 10 seconds of each podcast for the week and collating them for you in a personalized way based on observing you in order to manipulate you. That the bummer machine hasn't been applied to podcasts yet. It might be slightly in that you might get recommended certain podcasts, but you actually get the podcast as a whole when you get it at all. So far, podcasts are for real. You know, that's an example of the internet enabling a new media form that hasn't been compromised by this machine as yet. I mean, it could be. In the book, I give a horrible recipe and a vision of what that could be like if it happens. But so far, podcasts are the real thing.
Let's talk about what social media is doing to our sense of empathy. Because one of the things you point out is that we notice one another's reactions in order to get our own bearings. This is social perception, as you say.
Social perception, absolutely. Yeah.
And this is how you say, this is how humanity has survived. This is what's made us successful as a species. So what's happened in the new social media environment? How is that social perception breaking down?
Well, it's corrupted. I mean, the problem is that social perception, the distortion of social perception is approximately the thing that's for sale. when you can adjust what each person sees and when you can create all these fake people to create a false sense of social reality around a person, then you turn social perception into this thing that's totally compromised and a commercial product and fake. And that's, you know, just to be really blunt, as I said before, that is not something we can survive. To have fake social perception is to have fake perception, and in a world with real problems. And let me just list some of the real problems, like not the fake problems. We have problems that to me, like, they could be difficult. They might affect how rich we are. Like whether or not you agree with tariffs and trade wars, we'll survive either way. It might affect how wealthy we are, how much debt we take on, or that sort of thing. That's a policy question. It's not an existential threat. Climate change is. It's of a completely different order. Dealing with the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction really is. And another one is just planning for peak population. We're not going to have a population spiral forever on this planet, but we are going to have a high peak population later in the century. And where's the food and the fresh water going to come from exactly? And where are the people going to live as the climate changes? Those are real problems. Those are like hardcore. And we have to be able to perceive them clearly and talk about them honestly, and that's what we're not doing.
I love how you write about how crucial having what you call a theory of mind is for civility and for stories. Talk a little bit about this theory of mind, because I thought this was a really important idea. It's not that we've grown apart. It's that we can't understand each other.
Yeah. Theory of mind is a term that's often applied to animals. The question is, does an animal understand that another animal is understanding? You know, do they have a sense of each other as actors instead of just, you know, automata or something? The truth is, as soon as you start thinking about the topic of mind, you hit deep philosophical topics that can keep you up all night. But in this particular case, we can avoid those. And we can say that one crucial thing is that when you talk to another person, you have to have at least some sense of where that person's coming from if you want to have a conversation. Like if you're talking to somebody who just came back from war and is a traumatized veteran, you have to know that to be able to talk to that person. Mm-hmm. That's somebody that's different from somebody who just came back from a semester at prep school. And you have to understand that difference if you want to have a rational conversation with either person. Otherwise, it's going to go very wrong and you won't even know what the conversation's about. And so the thing is, if you have no way of knowing what somebody else has at least approximately been experiencing, it's very hard to have any kind of a real conversation with that person. And so the thing is, when everybody's getting individualized media feeds, and I'm not talking about, like, people used to watch different stations, or these days some people might watch Fox and some people might watch MSNBC or whatever. But the thing is, if I talk to somebody who says, oh, hey, I love Fox and I watch Fox, at least I watch Fox too, just so I can see what people are perceiving, so I can at least get where that person's coming from. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't create this impossible barrier between us. But if somebody's just been online a lot, I have nothing. I mean, I have no way of knowing where they're coming from. They are from another planet, and likewise me for them. And that level of mutual obscurity really, really, really makes it hard to connect in any deep way. I think it's one of the things that's tearing our society apart.
One of the things you write about is that you don't think Google, for example, is evil or Facebook is evil. You don't think this business model is so successful that it can't be changed at this point. But it seems like the thing we have to figure out is, how do you find a way to get people to be willing to pay for stuff that they now take for granted as being free? Because you think people can, and you think they – I mean, look at HBO and look at Netflix. I mean, these subscription models that are creating such great television right now, at least that seems like a decent model.
Yeah. So if you want to shut down the bummer business model, you have to replace it with something. And I think the obvious way to replace it is just to ask Google and Facebook to be normal businesses, which is to say that they sell products and services to customers, yeah, you know. Yeah. And so that means if you want to use search or social networking, you pay some affordable fee for it. There's a flip side to that, which is if you contribute a lot, like if you have some huge viral video, you should get paid. Right. It shouldn't be like right now, some people are paid on YouTube, but Google is acting like this communist market planner deciding who to pay and who not to. And they have to get the courage to trust in the market, let go of that control, and let the customers and the creators negotiate among themselves and create a much better market than a central controller ever could. That's what they need the faith to do. It's like suddenly Silicon Valley forgot about capitalism. It's the most bizarre thing. Mm. But anyway, yeah. So people say, well, if somebody's used to something for free, they'd never, never, never transition to paying for it. But they have. And you mentioned Netflix is a great example. People used to say, well, you can get video for free online. Every college kid does it. Who's ever going to pay for video? And the answer is, it didn't make life easy for Netflix, but Netflix rose to the occasion and said, you know what? If we provide a good enough service, if we produce good enough video, people will say, you know what? It's just easier for me to pay these people. I'm getting what I want. Yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
And it worked, you know, so why can't it work again? Since we actually have an existence proof, why not do that again? And then there are the people who say, oh, but it would be unfair to leave anybody out. The poor wouldn't be able to afford, you know, the internet. And so, you know, for books used to cost money. So we created an alternative called the public library. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Didn't put publishers out of business. It just created an alternative. And I don't see why we can't do that on the internet as well. So we can support the people who couldn't afford a fee. But that's no reason not to change the business. I mean, like to say that because there are poor people in the world, everybody must be subject to behavior modification is some just bizarre sicko idea. And yet it's kind of common. I mean, it's bizarre.
One of the arguments you make finally in the book, and you say that these aren't just practical things, that basically these confront, as you say, the deepest and most tender concerns of what it means to be a person. And you say that basically what we're doing right now when we give in to bummer technology is we accept this new spiritual framework. So talk about the sort of spiritual terms here, because this is really where you come down to, is it has a deeper kind of spiritual dynamic here for you.
Yeah. So what I think has happened is a lot of the core of Silicon Valley has taken on a new invention, that a new religion that we've just invented. And it's the way the religion works is we're the high priests because we can program, and the universe is a giant computer. People are little programs within that computer. And the purpose of reality is to optimize the programs, and people will eventually be subsumed by these AIs, which will be better programs, and they'll inherit the earth. And maybe your consciousness will live on forever inside an AI program if you're very, very nice to the tech companies that own the biggest computers that will take over reality. And then whenever you use these systems, you're sort of subsumed into this religion, whether you realize it or not. You're subsumed into a religion where whatever the algorithm responds to the most, whatever becomes viral because it's referred the most, is the thing that's the most real and true. And so it's this kind of theory of truth that's based on virality instead of anything else. You start to the companies say, you must give us all your data. It's good to share. But what they say publicly is that the reason they want your data is to create this AI that will put you out of a job. They say that even though your data is needed to create this robot that will put you out of a job, you still won't be paid because you're just a human and you're not worth as much as a tech company and our robots and our AIs. And we all buy into it. We've created the fastest and biggest sources of wealth concentration and power in the whole of history in these companies that are engaged in this AI race with each other. And so we're all being gradually subsumed through our actions into this new religion. And I really believe that even if you're an atheist, this new religion is inferior to your previous beliefs. I feel like it's like this giant degradation and lessening of spiritual feeling for the whole species to be brought into this thing, which I view as kind of a really degraded and nerdy and shallow and stupid religion. And even people who think on a daily basis they're adhering very strongly to traditional religious beliefs are in fact gradually through practice renouncing those beliefs in favor of the new tech religion every single day.
So the struggle is not to become a convert to this new kind of religious form.
Yeah. And the easiest way is to stop going to the services, you know, 35 times a day. Yeah. So delete your accounts and hold on to your soul.
Jaron Lanier, his latest book is called 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts. He's speaking tomorrow night at the Eccles Center in Park City. The event begins at 7:30. It's hosted by the Park City Institute. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.